Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Like, one of the things I talk about a lot with folks, like Rob and I were just talking about this, the generation that's about to age into voting, I think is just super, super left. So many of them are.
Well, that's what I think was really neat about this. Like, this girl literally laid out the connection between, like, you know, like K-pop type fandom actions, their online campaigns they had into political campaigns. And it's just neat to see them turn to political activism before they can even vote. And they have like an actual measurable effect on the outcome. Like, there are a lot of people who credit them with Markey's win, just because they trashed Kennedy so hard online.
Right, and they call themselves the Markeyverse, which I think is a pretty cool, and it's pretty cool to see an older man like that who's been established in the Democratic Party for so long, but also just quietly fighting for workers and fighting for progressive causes, kind of get his day of fame with people of that age. I think his part in writing the Green New Deal and the way that he has always championed those causes got folks like that to just jump right on board.
Yeah, and I think it's partially the Bernie effect too. Like, you know, I think younger people have an affection for an older person who stays liberal or goes even more left as they get older.
Right, and there has been a talk of lowering the voting age for citywide elections in Boston to 16 for a while now. And you know, I think under a new mayor, that we could potentially move in that direction. And I think it makes sense, especially for something like a citywide election. I think kids who are in the school system have a lot of skin in the game. And I think that, you know, especially the types of 16-year-olds who would go through the process of getting registered to vote tend to be pretty plugged in.
You know, they're a threat because a lot of boomers will be like, yeah, this generation is a bunch of snowflakes. All they do is whine. It seems like an intentional like hit job to discount their voice because they are engaged.
That was kind of one of the interesting parallels to like pop music fandom that I thought interesting. Like, so many people think like, oh, little girl music, oh, that's unserious stuff. You know, they're unserious people, they're children, you know, that's just pop trash. And, you know, they took their fervent fandom for that, and their kind of organizing they would do where they'd go ruin a Republican hashtag with like anime pictures. Or like, if you look to the whole like TikTok campaign against when Trump did his big comeback rally and Tulsa, and he was supposed to have a million people there, and he was touting all the ticket sales, and it was all TikTok kids, and then there are all the interior shots of the place being empty. I mean, that was kind of like a crossover moment for those kids, going from like fandom tactics of harassing someone who might not like the K-pop music you like to going for a politician who is anti-trans.
Right, and just to give listeners a sense of what we're talking about a recent article in the New York Times about an army of 16-year-olds, especially in Boston and the surrounding areas in Massachusetts, of young progressives, 16-year-old kids who are really plugged in and are kind of making change in whatever way they can, and also agitating to lower that voting age and basically just attack politicians that they see as threats to things that they hold dear. Like C-Money just mentioned, the idea of any politician who's anti-trans, they're just going to swarm them online and really make their presence known. And I think it's fantastic. As a civics teacher in Boston, this is really getting me pretty excited. I kind of want to talk about this with my students and talk about how they could potentially get involved in similar ways.
Like ground level campaign operations, like constant texting and DM on the behalf of their candidate. Like, they were able to flip that into to something super useful like that. And at the same time, they're taking on the jobs of like higher up campaign ops, doing opposition research on like Democratic incumbents to push them left, you know, threatening to come after them if they don't accept these policies. It's just a really interesting development for kids who can't even vote yet.
Right. And kind of where they made their first mark was what you were talking about, C-Money, with the Ed Markey versus Joe Kennedy, the third race. And, you know, Joe Kennedy kind of just left his House seat with this idea that he just deserved a Senate seat because of, you know, his family.
His last name.
Yeah, his family legacy. And he really thought that that last name would carry him. And at first, for a very long time in that race, it seemed like it would. I talked to many people who said, oh, this is really sad because Markey is a champion of the progressive causes, but he's just going to lose out because of his opponent's last name. And then this group and many other groups really, I mean, AOC rallied behind Markey as well at the end, and Markey actually ended up trouncing Joe Kennedy III.
There's been an interesting development since. You know, it's not like they just won and took a victory lap and are, you know, the Markeyverse forever. He released a statement in support of Israel last week, and his own Markeyverse kind of started to fold in on him. Like, the kids came after him to hold him to account. And so he actually issued a second statement acknowledging the Palestinian situation as well.
That is pretty impressive. Yeah, because usually it's the concern of the elected leader is, oh, what are voters going to think? Or what are the
voters are donors? Yeah,
right. Exactly. So on this episode, we are going to talk to Rob Smith, who is an expert. He's got a law degree. He's got a PhD. He writes a blog called Margin of Error that's got a lot of fantastic political commentary. But he's going to break down the census, why the census is late, what is apportionment, which you might have been hearing lately, and gerrymandering especially. We're going to talk about that. So, you know, there's a lot of new developments that have come about because of the census. I mean, the most glaring, of course, is the low birth rate, which for me screams, we really need to open up our immigration process and bring in folks, because that has been how the U.S. has typically grown its population and had such a, you know, a lively working class and, you know, middle class because of immigrant energy and immigrant labor and immigrant families.
Well, it's going to really hinder recovery from coronavirus if you have jobs and no people to work them. And that's the direct situation we have in Maine right now. We have too many jobs, not enough people.
So are you saying that the xenophobia caucus is not the right route to go?
It did not work for the
productive.
It didn't work for the Know Nothing Party either in U.S. history. So it's typically been a pretty short-lived move towards xenophobia in U.S. history. And it hopefully will die out with Trump.
Hopefully with these kids.
Yeah, let's hope these kids can do it. So there is going to be a slight change in terms of the balance of power in Congress, or at least the balance of representatives. And Rob's going to break down how that happens. But, you know, we have some pretty notable things that have happened. Like California, for instance, is slated to lose a seat in the House of Representatives. And then what will happen is each of these states will take the data from the census and go ahead and start drawing up new maps. Now, some states kind of try to keep their maps looking quite similar, but some states do go ahead and redraw lines. And that, what really matters there is, and Dan and I were talking about this the other day, is the fact that the Tea Party, from the moment they were on the scene, they took over every state house they possibly could, right? They ran for every state representative position. They tried to change the balance of power because they knew, or at least someone running that show, probably one of the Koch brothers, knew that's where these decisions are made. And that's ultimately what's going to decide on the balance of power in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Right. And it also, that's where they're launching all these anti-trans bills, and it gins up like a lot of grassroots support. Whereas if they didn't have the state power, they wouldn't be able to get the base as fired up.
Well, and they kind of stake out a position in the state itself. Like, a lot of these Republican governors are passing laws that don't let municipalities have mask mandates or preclude a lot of things that municipalities normally do. It's kind of like a Jacksonian, Calhounian approach to government, where the state is even more powerful than the federal government. And that's right. Where they, that's how they like it.
And one of the scarier things is what's happening with anti-abortion bills. And I was listening to The Takeaway, and they had some experts on there running through some of the ways that abortion access has been limited. And one of the, some of the things that really shocked me were state legislatures will pass laws that dictate how wide the hallways have to be in abortion clinics. And, you know, it sounds like some boring thing that, that should be on like an insurance claim or something like that. But what it really does is these cash-strapped abortion clinics end up having to close down because they can't just, you know, go ahead and renovate their entire building and widen the hallways. And so we're seeing this go on in Texas, you know, with Governor Abbott signing the 6-week limit on abortions. And it just seems like it's a drumbeat that's heading towards, you know, with our Supreme Court the way it is right now with conservatives in the majority, some way to either weaken or at least completely dismantle Roe v. Wade.
I mean, my understanding, though, of Roe v. Wade is that even if it was overturned, that it would just put the abortion issue back to the states, and then you'd have like the ultra conservative states would do shady shit, and then other states would just keep it as is. Is that right?
Yeah. What ends up happening there, though, is that you just don't have this universal statement that women deserve a right to choose.
Or of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And states like Massachusetts and many other states, New York, California, have in anticipation of this put in some really strict rules kind of protecting Roe v. Wade type things.
Well, I did really want to talk about the tourist visit that happened at the Capitol on January 6th. You know, those nice elderly people with their cameras and
yeah, the little walk through.
They bought the shirt. I'm with the orange guy. Yeah. So Kevin McCarthy a while back appointed this dude, John Katko from New York, to basically come up with a bipartisan commission. And it's literally split five Republicans, five Democrats. So it's 10 members. They both have equal subpoena power to call witnesses. So now you have both McCarthy, who appointed the dude, and Mitch McConnell being like, yeah, so what happened was. So I think they're proving that any attempt at bipartisanship is just a fool's errand, as if, you know, if this was 2014, like Mitch McConnell wouldn't be jamming this up their ass. Didn't the Benghazi commission have like, you know, 33 hearings or something like that? You know, this is the idea that you're going to get a fair shake from the Republican Party is foolish. And I say we just forget about them because they're not going to investigate anything. It's not in their best interest.
Right. It's not in their best interest. Everyone's showing that they are, in fact, still scared of Trump, and that fealty to Trump is still the most important thing in terms of folks in the GOP wanting to stay in office. But from a really simple homeland security, you might call it, standpoint, there are some real vulnerabilities there that I think need to be looked at. Now, we do run the risk of kind of chasing that rabbit and not keeping our eye on the prize of, you know, Joe Biden continuing to, like at this moment, he seems really in support of some big government type stuff, some big spending plans. The infrastructure bill still hasn't been passed. The American Families Plan, some of these things need to get done in order to really provide some real pandemic relief, because so many people are not out of the woods yet. And as soon as those eviction moratoriums end, then there are going to be a lot of people on the street or scrambling to find a place to stay. And so, you know, I that is my one concern with pushing some type of commission. Now, the reality is, like the 9/11 Commission, for instance, that can operate in the background. All they have to do is vote on it, decide who's going to be on the commission, and then just have that commission run, just set aside some money to pay for it, and they can go ahead and get a report months from now.
But just to push back on that a little bit, Pat, the whatever this commission, there will be some sort of commission, whether it's watered down or bipartisan or whatever, but it's going to set the rules of the road for 2024. I mean, you got to think that the Republicans, whoever they run, are going to try some stuff in 2024, especially if they have the House.
Oh, absolutely. But they're going to try stuff no matter what happens, right? So, like, are you thinking that the commission needs to happen to push those people out of power now?
I'm just saying that they might be able to enact some reforms that could be applicable in 2024. But I actually, tell me what you guys think about this. Let's imagine that too many. So there were 35 House Republicans that voted for the commission, right? Let's say that too many GOP House members end up speaking up and they all get primaried, right? And all these primary people are like far right QAnon conspiracy people. Doesn't that sort of help the Democrats because they're running against like a cray-cray candidate? Or I mean, does I think it depend on the district?
I would think it would depend on the district. Like, I think deep south, that's not really going to matter. It'll even be an enticement. Like, hey, it's someone crazier than we could have run before.
Right. Yeah, it's going to absolutely depend on the district. And it also really depends on just kind of like shaking these ideas out of people who believe them. Like, it's just, it's frightening for me that 70% of the Republican base still thinks that Trump was cheated out of the election when there's really no evidence. I mean, you can look for bamboo fibers all you want in ballots in Arizona, but there's just no evidence. And any evidence that we've seen of cheating in elections has been committed by the very people who are levying that claim against the Democrats here. It's frustrating to know that that many people still hold that false belief.
I just don't know that you can de-escalate them from where they are, because they just listen to sources that tell them what they've been told the past 5 or 6 years, that everything they don't like is fake and reality is a hoax against them.
Yeah,
I think you just got to beat them at the ballot box. I don't know that you can convince.
Well, and I think relating back to the Markiverse way that we opened, I do think we're in kind of a waiting game here. And eventually enough of these folks are going to age out, and they're going to age out of relevance. And we're going to have these Gen Z people become voters. And when that happens, I do think we're going to kind of flood the zone with progressive voters. Now, I can't say that I know that's true of the children of the people who are running around spouting QAnon stuff, and there are far too many of them. But I just feel like the balance of power is eventually going to shift.
I'm just looking at the target list that the DCCC has for 2022. Bunch of California seats. Don't you have a little teaser for us, Pat? Don't you have a little someone coming on the pod who's running in California?
Yeah, so I was able to secure an interview with Lauren Hubbard. He's organizing right now to run for the Democratic nomination to challenge Devin Nunes, who was one of the top Trump lackeys. You might remember him in such moves as racing over to the White House to give Trump information in terms of like where the House was on figuring out just what Trump had known or had not known about the whole Ukrainian situation. So Devin Nunes, one of his potential opponents, hopefully Lauren Hubbard will be able to pull it off. And we'll talk about that when we have him on. But he supports, the big issues that progressives, you know, socialists like me really care about, like Medicare for All, for instance. And it would just be, I think, a lot of fun to see that race play out between, you know, a Black American who really cares deeply about the people and about the issues that would make a real difference in people's lives, and someone like Devin Nunes, who is just doing whatever he can to feed the Trump base and stay in power that way.
His district is a pretty big Republican stronghold, isn't it? Like some Inland Empire area place.
I do believe it has some of that Jefferson County where they want to secede and start their own Jeffersonian nation.
The Cal exit, yeah.
But just as I was, you know, mentioning before, we've got a shift in an area like that. You're going to see a shift in the children of migrants who are born here and have aged into voting. And, I think Lauren Hubbard, and I'll ask him about that in terms of what his chances are to win. But he might see an opportunity.
Yeah, I'll be interested to hear from him.
It's interesting because I think of California as being super liberal. But, you know, Kevin McCarthy's from California. Devin Nunes is from California.
The Republicans there just won the recall drive for Newsom, didn't they?
Yeah, and let's not forget that Ronald Reagan came out of California. He was governor of California. And this is exactly what we're going to hear in this interview coming up with Rob Smith, is how these lines are drawn state by state to make sure that, you know, for instance, in California, that you draw a district that leaves out a lot of the liberal vote and then kind of either cracks or packs that vote, that voting base into its own district so that you can secure certain districts that will always vote red. Guest on this episode is Rob Smith, author of the Margin of Error blog. He got his PhD from UC Berkeley in city and regional planning and a law degree from Cardozo Law School in New York City. He's also got a master's degree in labor studies. He is highly qualified for this interview from UMass Amherst. Rob, welcome to the pod. We're really excited to have you.
Thanks, Pat. I'm really happy to be here.
So could you just start off by giving us a bit of your background? I think our listeners would be interested in hearing about what you do with unions, and then we'll get into kind of redistricting and what that is going to look like.
Sure. I've worked with unions for a long time, sometimes more intensely than others, but my background goes way back to college, where I was working on environmental issues and labor issues. And so, you know, the Tony Mazzocchi sort of ideas of a worker superfund concept resonated with me from a long time ago. So I've worked on a number of different issues, with a focus on workplace issues, SEIU and Unite Here. I worked with the United Farm Workers for a while. And then after that, I get into doing land use planning work, primarily with low-income communities and on redevelopment planning, and particularly out here in California. And the work that I did there was in coalition with a lot of unions and community-based organizations.
I think at some point we're going to have you back on the show to kind of really flesh out that work with unions. I'd love to hear more about it. But we brought you on the show for this episode to talk about redistricting and what it has to do with the census. And I think listeners might have also heard recently in the news the word apportionment. Could you give us a brief background on that?
Apportionment is actually the reason why we have the census in the first place. Okay, just so there's a relationship between these three different concepts: the census, apportionment, and redistricting. So apportionment is the term that people are probably most unfamiliar with, as you said, Pat, and it's the process by which Congress determines how many representatives in the House of Representatives each state gets. Constitution just assigned a number of seats to different states with the idea that within 3 years after adopting the Constitution, they would conduct a census, and using that information, they would decide how many seats each state should get in relation to one another. And early on, they tried to get as close to the maximum amount of seats that's constitutionally permissible. And there's no number that that's true of. What the Constitution does say is that you cannot have any more than one person representing 30,000 people. So there's not going to be, constitutionally, a House district cannot have less than 30,000 people. If we were to employ that today, we'd have a House representatives of about 1,100 people. But but about 100 years ago or so, Congress capped the number of representatives at 435. So as the population has grown, the size of the House has not, but so the size of the districts have. And right at the first apportionment in 1791, the average size of a House district was 34,000 people. Today, it's, I think with the most recent census, it's going to be somewhere about 780,000, 790,000.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets to be a problem after for a while as to how close to the people the representatives really are, because the idea, one of the ideas anyways behind the House, is that that was going to be the branch of the federal government that was closest to the people. And as it is right now, it's sort of like my representative out here in California represents, you know, to almost 300,000 more people than the representative in Wyoming does. Right. But there's a reason for that, too, that's in the Constitution, and that's that the Constitution guarantees that every state gets at least one representative. So no matter what their population is. So apportionment needs to happen on some sort of regular basis so that as population grows or shrinks, but in relative from one state relative to another over time, there can be relatively equal representation for the people, and that states are getting the sort of relative representation that they should get in the House. And so it was decided that the count, the enumeration, as it's called in the Constitution, which we call the census, would happen every 10 years. So the census takes place because it's required to under the Constitution. Redistricting is something different, right? And redistricting is where once you have the apportionment, once you know how many seats that your state has, you need to draw those districts. And they used to be drawn in very, very unequal ways. And I'm not referring simply to in racial terms, although that was an issue and remains to be an issue ongoing today. But the bigger challenge was often that rural districts would be weighed more heavily as far as representation goes than urban areas were. Now, part of that had to do with the fact that there was not really many urban areas to begin with. And as states actually didn't redraw their districts over time, many states didn't. And that's one of the reasons why in the 60s, there were a number of cases that the Supreme Court heard and ruled on. Sort of collectively, people think of them as the one man, one vote cases, but they were dealing with all sorts of different levels of government in those cases to sort of equalize representation within states. So a state like Georgia might have gone 100 years without redrawing its districts. So over time, while its population changed, maybe the number of seats changed and they would need to draw a new district, or maybe they would need to get rid of a district, and that would be the one time that the state would decide to redraw. But generally speaking, a number of states, not all of them, but a number of states just simply did not redraw their districts over time. Now, states can't get away with that anymore because of the one man, one vote cases in the 60s and their progeny. We still have cases like that coming up through the system even today. There are some places where you can read up on the sort of history of apportionment. I have a few books I could recommend, but I'm not going to because it's basically math for the most part. It's history through math. And if you really like math, you might not be crazy about the history. And if you really like history, the math may put you to sleep. Right? You know, the issue is that one person's vote should not be worth more or less than another person's vote. Sure. Right. And if you have one district where, say, you're one person who represents 100 residents, and on another part of the state, you have a representative that represents 10,000 residents, the weight of your vote in the smaller district is stronger than the weight of your vote in the bigger district, because your vote is more meaningful to electing the representative, all right?
Yeah, I teach this to students as influence. So your influence in that small district is much greater on your representative.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there are a number of ways in which your vote gets diluted as the size of the district or the constituency you're in gets bigger. But it may get diluted in an absolute sense, but that's okay. If it gets diluted in a relative sense, that's not okay. And so the districts need to be relatively equal. Now, the reason I brought up the math is because Congress is, starting from the beginning, have tackled this issue. It seems to be easy. Right. It seems to be easy when you think of it. This is an easy math problem, but it's not an easy math problem thanks to fractions. Right. So no matter how you divvy this stuff up, you're going to end up having problems like an apportionment where some state should get 10.5 seats. You can't have a 0.5 seat. It's either going to be 11 seats or it's going to be 10 seats. Right.
Yeah.
And so you have to figure out how you are going to resolve that. And you need to resolve it in a way. In that case, that's apportionment. You need to resolve it in a way that's sort of fair across states and also complies with like some of the other constitutional rules. When you are looking at getting that sort of same kind of relative proportionality within a state, it's not so much about the 10.5 seats anymore. It's about the state that has, let's say, the state that has 790,000 resident constituency now. You know, if you think about a state with 2 million people, you can easily make a district of 790,000 and then another district of 790,000, but the next district is going to be less than 790,000.
Right.
Does one district just get fewer people, or do you equalize it out? And what the courts have said is that you need to equalize it out, but it's never going to be perfectly equal. And there are a number of different reasons why that might be the case, including the fact that the data that you're using is fluid. Even by the time you start redistricting, the data is already over a year old, right? So in that case, you need to sort of get within, I think what the standard is with the courts is if districts are within about 10% population of one another, that's considered to satisfy the one person, one vote standard. I've been using one man, one vote because that's what the courts say, and they've never changed it as far as I know, you know, so they're still using that language from the 60s. But those are some of the challenges with the math on redistricting.
Okay, so you've covered apportionment, redistricting, and the census kind of broadly, but what is gerrymandering and how does that come into play?
Gerrymandering is a phenomenon that happens through drawing districts. It's not something that is unique to the United States, but the term itself was actually created here. It was created in Massachusetts, as a matter of fact. I've been told, although I don't know this, that in Marblehead, where Governor Eldridge Gerry was from, it is still referred to as gerrymandering and not gerrymandering, but someone in Marblehead can tell me differently here. But so, and that's apparently the way it was called initially, because that's how you pronounce the Gerry's name. And he, interestingly enough, was not a proponent of gerrymandering, but he signed a redistricting bill in 1812 that had this crazy district that went on like the North Shore of Boston and just went linked town to town like a little snake or salamander, went out west, came down, and then like landed in Chelsea. And there's another more compact district that it surrounds.
Wow.
And if you think that's crazy, I recommend that you check out the map for Maryland's third district, which is also snakes like that, but it at several points is not even connected to itself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And there's no requirement that it be, at least in the Constitution, right? And so gerrymandering, there are two main ways of gerrymandering, and they're referred to as cracking and packing. Okay, so, and cracking is where the authority that redistricts, and maybe I should back up here just a second to say that traditionally the state legislature would do the districting, would draw the districts. So that was the redistricting authority. Mm-hmm. And that still is the default. It still is true, except that in a number of states, and it's been increasing every few years, we see independent commissions. And there are a couple of states where they actually have partisan commissions. Independent commissions are more found out west, and they tend to have at least an equal number. So it'd be like an X amount of Democrats, same amount of Republicans, and then same amount of independents on it, with a number of different criteria that they'll use generally to avoid gerrymandering, but I'm not sure that that's true across all the rules for the commissions. They're all different in whatever state you're in. There's two states that have, they call it a partisan commission, which they're usually designed so that there's some amount of Democrats, some amount of Republicans, probably equal, but I'm not sure if that's true in both cases. And then they pick like the tiebreaker chairperson.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And then there are advisory commissions. So but those are all basically functions of the sort of Republican system that states have, right? So that state legislatures can create these independent commissions or partisan commissions, or in some states like New York, an advisory commission. So the folks who draw the districts traditionally had partisan interests in drawing them. And cracking is when they would draw districts in such a way to dilute the political power of their opposition by dividing them into different districts so that they would be political minorities in those districts. And that's what the Massachusetts salamander there, the district we were just talking about, that the name was coined from, that's what that was designed to do. So it snaked through a number of different towns in Massachusetts that were Democratic Republican. That was the party at the time that opposed, that was one of the two major parties, the other one being the Federalists. Yeah. So those were Democratic Republican communities, and they avoided Federalist communities in other towns so that they would elect another Democratic Republican representative, and the Federalists would be dispersed in some other districts where they would not be able to mount a competitive challenge to the party in power. Now, packing is where you decide to give the opposition a seat by just putting as many of them in there as possible. And by packing, you're also, in a way, kind of also cracking, because what you're doing is you're removing the political power of your opposition from a number of different districts, allowing you to be able to win them, but you're conceding that they're going to win this district. And we do see packing a lot these days. And in some ways, packing is a solution to some of the racial gerrymandering we saw. So that where the it's not strictly speaking a gerrymander, it's something that is a solution that came through the Voting Rights Act to processes to make sure that there were minority-majority districts so that there would be some representation. Like non-white folks would actually have a chance of winning a seat, where in a number of these southern states, they were districted in such a way that even though, you know, non-white folks, particularly African-Americans, made up a significant minority of the state population, but still couldn't get anyone elected against the white power structure in those states. But packing isn't just done to sort of solve that kind of problem. It's also done purposely to water down the political power of the opposition. You know, we see that in Ohio now with Cleveland gets a seat, then the rest of like Northeast Ohio is represented by Republicans. So that does happen. You know, it's the cracking is a problem. The packing can be done in such a way that it solves some problems. It's certainly a lot better to be able to elect someone in one district rather than zero districts. So that's what gerrymandering is. Now, gerrymandering is not illegal. It's not unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Again, with an asterisk, because you cannot district in such a way that you run afoul of the one person, one vote standard, or in such a way that disadvantages racial minorities. So those are the two areas in which the court has said this is a case that is properly before the court and the court has competence to resolve, whereas your general sort of partisan gerrymandering is considered a political question, meaning it's not for the courts to decide. It's for the political branches, Congress and the president, to weigh in on. And there was a Supreme Court case that upheld that just about 2 years ago in 2019. So it's not some old case ready for being revisited here. As it stands right now, we're not going to find any luck in the courts on trying to overturn any kind of partisan redistricting.
Okay. And you touched on this a little bit, but as a civics teacher who teaches mostly Black and Brown students, I always feel like it's really important for me to teach students how certain aspects of our government are legacies of slavery or racism, white supremacy. Like, for instance, the Electoral College. I always try to make connections for my students. Is there a connection between redistricting and slavery or the white supremacy upon which our country was founded?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't mean to be glib about it, but pretty much everything that happened in the Constitutional Convention has some sort of impact or legacy on slavery and white supremacy.
Sure.
You know, and so it's important to note that apportionment itself is not just important for representatives in the House. It also gives states votes in the Electoral College. So the way the Electoral College works is that each state gets a vote for president that is the number of senators they have, which is two for every state, plus the number of representatives they have. Okay, so Texas, for instance, is gaining two seats in the House as a result of this latest census. What that means is they're going to get two more votes in the Electoral College. And if the last year's election was held under the apportionment that we have now, Joe Biden still would have won the election, but instead of winning a 306 electoral votes, he would have won 303 electoral votes. So when we think about the role that the Electoral College has played vis-a-vis white supremacy and slave power in this country, the relationship between the census and the apportionment is significant, because that's how we determine the representation of the Electoral College. And the Electoral College, you know, many folks like to describe it as being an institution that was designed to protect slavery. It's not clear to me that that's a completely accurate interpretation of why the Electoral College was created. The framers had discussed having Congress elect the president. What they were afraid of was democracy, to be honest with you. That's what they were afraid of. You know, I mean, when you look at how the government was set up, the House of Representatives was the only branch of government in which the people had any kind of direct responsibility for. The Senate was appointed by state legislatures.
Right.
You know, and even then, like the states made the rules as to who could vote. So largely it was just white male 21 or over who owned property who yeah. could, you know,
and so landowners absolutely is something I like to make sure my students know, because that is, I think, mind boggling for folks who, you know, vote nowadays to think that you had to show that you own land in order to vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was true well into the 19th century. It was basically the sort of Jacksonian era where that stuff started to change. You know, if you can find someone who can get into power and they realize they can stay in power by having a certain group of people support them, then they all of a sudden become very interested in enfranchising those people, which is kind of what happened during the Jacksonian period. Sometimes it doesn't work very well for our values, but sometimes, you know, it turns out to be progress, even if it comes out of having to elect somebody who was actually really kind of a dirtbag, I guess you could say.
So. Yeah, and someone who committed genocide, but yes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah. So, I mean, he's no role model.
No, he was not.
And if you have no other way of understanding that, he was Donald Trump's favorite president. So there you go.
Yep. So why is this, speaking of Donald Trump, why is the census late this year?
There's a few reasons. Some will be obvious. You know, we can say we had a pandemic and we still have a pandemic, but we ended up having to do the census coinciding with some really bad time during the pandemic. So the census day is April 1st in a year ending in zero. So last year it was April 1, 2020. Now, what that means is that's the day that we count people, right? Now, we don't literally count everybody on April 1st. But where you live on April 1st is what's relevant for the census. It used to be more true that that census field staff would count everybody. Now, people are able to sort of self-report, whether they do it through the mail or whether they do it online. I filled out my census online last year. But that's still, if I remember correctly, only gets at about a third of the people. So there's still a lot of people that need to be counted. Now, sometimes they'll respond after just some urging from the census. So a number of those people who didn't respond or didn't self-report, once they're reminded, they do. They may get a phone call or something, or maybe another notification in the mail, I think. But what they do is they hire a lot of temporary field staff to go out there and knock on doors of the houses that have not responded, you know, and that takes a lot of work ahead of time, where the census folks are actually making lists of every single household in the United States so that they know who to contact. There's a number of different ways they do that too, including using satellite imagery like you would use for, you know, Google Maps or whatever. So when the field staff hits the ground and starts knocking on doors is April. So if you can remember a year ago, we had just started shutting things down in April last year. You know, it was the mid to late March when a number of states said, everyone's got to stay home. And because the census is a federal agency run by, at that time, an incompetent guy who was lying to us about what was going on with the pandemic. And I'm sorry if that's not neutral enough, but that's what was happening. They just decided to keep it going. And they just planned to keep going forward with the field work. But once May came, that came to an abrupt halt. Now, why that did, whether it was a revolt within the census saying we can't be knocking on doors, whether states were telling the census to stop doing it, or whether people just simply wouldn't do it. You know, maybe it's a combination of all those things, but the census stopped doing its field work in May and stopped for 3 months over the summer. So that alone pushed back the data collection process. Again, probably you were looking at 40 or 50% of people that needed to be counted. I don't know what the exact number was, but it's a big number. So now what we have is a delay in being able to collect that information. And if you recall, things seemed to be getting a little better at the beginning of the summer, but then it got a lot worse again, right? So we had a problem over the summer.
Yeah.
So that was an important delay. And then when we got out of that in the fall, we had a number of different problems. At the end of the summer and the fall, natural disasters, urban unrest, things like that, that complicated the ability of the census field staff to do their job. Some other related police brutality protests and the reactions to them made things problematic for the census field staff to count in urban areas, which is often where the field staff is going. There are two areas where it often becomes very difficult to count by geography as opposed to, say, by demography. And that's in the inner city and in far-flung rural areas. It's hard to get a good count. You need to sort of go door to door typically. Yeah. There. So that made it challenging also. So it became kind of, there's sort of like a perfect storm of sort of natural events that made the delay inevitable for this year. But on top of it, we had this issue with the Republicans trying to depress immigrants from reporting on the census. We know from legal documents that have been released that was what Republicans were trying to do. But of course, we didn't need to see those documents. We could just tell from what was going on. So they could not make the argument, although Trump tried to make the argument, that undocumented residents should not be counted. The Constitution requires that everybody be counted. It doesn't make a difference whether you're a citizen, whether you're a legal immigrant, or an undocumented immigrant. It doesn't matter. Everyone gets counted. What the solution was for them to try to depress the immigrant response rate on the census was to add a question asking what someone's citizenship is. Now, one of the ways that this grabbed some traction here is, number one, it doesn't sound like it just sounds like you're collecting information, which is what the census does, right? You know?
Yeah.
And that question has also been asked by the census at other times, but not on the decennial census, usually in trying to get its yearly population estimates. The census does sample every single year, and they do population estimates over the years, and they, in addition to the decennial census. And those population estimates are used for a wide variety of reasons, but they're not used for the constitutionally important reason of apportionment. So the debate over adding that question and in the legal case over it also took some time, but that in itself didn't specifically delay the census. What it did is it added a degree of uncertainty into what the census was supposed to be doing. That apparently created a number of sort of stops and starts at the census that also contributed to the delay. So at the end of the day, those are the elements that came together that created the delay. Normally, we would have all the redistricting data that we need from the census by March 31st, and it won't be ready until at least August this year. And that's a problem for some states that use census data for redistricting because they have early primaries 2022. And you have to back up from those primaries through the sort of election calendars in order to like draw the districts. So for some of these states, not being able to start drawing a district until the fall is really, really late for them. And it actually bumps up very close to their sort of legal deadlines and being able to hold elections. One solution to that is they don't need to redraw the districts for 22. They could probably do it in 24. It might depend on state law for that. So that's what the challenge is of the census data being late. Once we know what the apportionment is for the states, that's easy. That's not the important information that states need to draw districts. Apportionment just tells you how many seats your state's going to get. But drawing the districts is a much more complex problem.
So it's just going to take more of that detailed data. So why do you think the census was designed to count all people in a state as opposed to just documented citizens? And why does it also use the phrase all free persons?
It uses the phrase all free persons because they were slaves and they were counting slaves as well. That's the reason for that was, I suppose, to make sure that there was no misunderstanding about the fact that everybody had to be counted. Now, why did they include undocumented people? Now, they didn't specifically include undocumented. There was no such thing as undocumented aliens or residents in the 18th century. I mean, if you wanted to come to the United States, you could just come to the United States.
Right.
You know, I mean, but the thing is there was not sort of barriers to immigration the way there are now. As a matter of fact, there weren't, those barriers largely didn't exist except for some really awful racial prohibitions, particularly like the Chinese Exclusion Act for a long time. So our sort of immigration quotas and all this are a relatively recent phenomenon in history, really going back to about like the 60s. Okay. The way the framers were looking at who gets counted is that they're just people who live there. Some of them are free and some of them are enslaved. And they wanted to count everybody. And the reason they wanted to count everybody is because some people wanted to count slaves for the purposes of apportionment and other people didn't. And that was largely on a regional basis because the North, where there was very little slavery, even though slavery had been largely made illegal in many places in the North during the sort of revolutionary period, which is something about the revolution that is actually revolutionary that people don't talk about a whole lot, is the sort of emancipations that took place across the North during the revolution. But there were slaves counted in every single state in the 1790 census, except for Massachusetts. Massachusetts had zero, but everybody else had some number of slaves. And some of them in the South had a significant number of slaves.
Sure.
Right. Virginia in particular. The Northern states largely did not want slaves to be counted because, well, they weren't otherwise members of the political community in any way, even like the men over 21. And even if they might have owned property, which was extremely unusual, but it was not technically impossible that a slave somewhere in the South could own some property. They were just not allowed to be part of the political community at all. And it was, in the North, they recognized it as simply a way to try to maximize their political power, right?
So sure, yeah.
No slave was ever going to be elected anything. There was no one who was going to represent slaves, right?
Right, you know? Yeah.
The Southern states thought that that was hypocritical of the North because these were people, although for some reason, this was the only time that they seemed to want to believe that slaves were people. There was a compromise so that slaves would be counted 40% of a free person. That's the three-fifths clause. What was interesting about that is the framers of the Constitution decided to tie taxation and representation together. Might not seem so silly if you think about the, you know, no taxation without representation cry, but I'm imagining a lot of people listening probably thought that that was something probably more made up for in the popular imagination than was really operative during the revolutionary period, but it wasn't. It was actually a real serious issue that the framers wanted to incorporate into the document here, that there was going to be some sort of connection between representation and taxation. And it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to us right now because we don't really have direct taxation now. We rely on an income tax. Direct taxes are a headcount. So it's like if you have 1 million people in your state, then you owe the federal government, you know, $100 million, $100 a head. That's the way it would work.
Interesting.
Right. So it was all a bunch of compromises around that, but it also operated as a way to discourage states from trying to cheat on the census count because they could get more population if they were able to do that, but they'd also have to pay more taxes.
So if we're going to look at maybe the last decade or two, can you point to one political party that's done a better job of redistricting, or has it been kind of a wash?
It's hard to say. I mean, what's better at redistricting?
I guess consolidating power.
Yeah, I mean, have they used it more effectively, you know, for their own political gains? I think overall the Republicans have done that because they cared less about whether they were doing anything that may have violated any kind of democratic principles. They haven't really cared about that. So for Republicans, largely, it's been mostly a power grab, but not completely. You know, I mean, it's the Republican Party today is not the same Republican Party it was decades ago, although that Republican Party created this one, that's for sure. The idea of like independent commissions in some ways was, I don't know if it's fair to call it a Republican idea, but Republicans certainly supported that. And so that some of the commissions, you know, a lot of these sort of what you might call like good government solutions that you see largely in Western states often had a bit of a kind of a conservative genesis to them, largely because they were trying to fight back at the sort of urban growth machines of the party patronage machines that were in the cities,
like Tammany Hall, for instance.
Yeah. I mean, you see that all over, but you know, some of their solutions weren't always that great, you know. I mean, the sort of commission style of local government, which doesn't really exist anymore, but it's why you have terms like police commissioner and fire commissioner. Originally, in a lot of communities that embraced the sort of commission form of government, you basically had agency heads, but you didn't really have any legislators or executives like we think of it. It didn't last very long because it just simply was not practical. But we see some legacies of that. Now, the ballot question, you know, having been able to enact initiatives or referend laws on the ballot is also part of the sort of good government solutions here. And, you know, to get around state legislators being in the thrall of corruption or whatever. So trying to get around state governments for redistricting purposes was very much a sort of good government kind of problem that folks wanted to solve. And a lot of those folks were Republicans of their time wanting to do that. The state that does redistricting the best, let's put it that way, is the state I live in right now, which is California. I think that the Independent Redistricting Commission here is really the gold standard of it. And, you know, the funny thing about it is the Republicans wanted it. You know, this is a function of what I call the don't believe your own bullshit problem here in politics. We see it often in campaigns where people will say, the data that we have says that we're really strong. You know, we have a chance of winning this, when they know damn well that their internal polling shows that they're losing badly. The problem is when you actually believe that, so you lose the election, you're like, wait a minute, I told everyone I was going to win. This was obviously fraudulent, right? You know, so that's one of those problems here. That we see in politics come up time and time again. You often see it played out, like I said, in campaigns, but it played out in the redistricting issue here in California, because the Republicans wanted a redistricting commission because they claim that the Democrats, which controlled the legislature, were too partisan, you know, and couldn't be trusted to fairly draw up districts so that people would be represented. And that's one reason why Republicans didn't have as much political power coming out of California, why they had fewer seats in the state legislature and in the House of Representatives. So devised this independent redistricting commission that has some pretty aspects to it where the commissioners are actually picked at random after a sort of process of interviewing folks and getting them down to a pool of something like 80 or whatever. And then they're just picked randomly as long as they have like an equal number of Democrats, Republicans, and political independents on it. They hold public hearings. There's criteria designed to make sure that the districts are compact as much as possible. Other states have rules like this too, and that they're not actually gerrymandering. So what happened from the first redistricting from that commission? The Republicans lost seats. You know why? Because the Democrats had assumed that the Republicans, I guess, were more popular than they actually turn out to be in California.
Oh, wow.
Although what it probably was they were giving the Republicans, they'd given them a little extra advantage so that they wouldn't complain about it so much. And also, this is less true now, but it was more true years ago that legislatures tended to protect incumbents unless they had a reason not to, right?
Yeah.
So after that redistricting in 2010, the Republicans put a question on the ballot to repeal it.
Wow.
You know, after they had supported it the whole time. So because at some point they actually, like I said, believe their own bullshit that somehow they were much more popular than they actually are in California. And that if we just did a redistricting fairly and logically, you know, professionally and get the politics out of it, then the Republicans would take their rightful place as close to a 50% party in California. Instead, there's been a supermajority of Democrats since then. You know?
Right. It's like the silent majority stuff that Reagan and, you know, right, people since then have talked about. So does gerrymandering stand as a barrier to democratically instituting social programs like Medicare for All or other robust social safety net programs? And if so, how?
I mean, if we're talking about gerrymandering specifically, the one way in that impacts our ability to be able to enact progressive legislation is where progressive political power is diffused through that process. It's not clear to me that gerrymandering has made as much of an impact on the overall political power structure federally as folks assume that it does. It certainly can make a difference here and there locally. Whether, like, say, the Democrats would have 25 or 30 or 50 new seats if it weren't for gerrymandering, I don't think that's true. But in any case, it does make some difference. And it can make a significant difference if it's used in certain ways. And how that impacts our ability to enact progressive policies is sort of indirect from the gerrymandering. It will impact who gets elected in congressional districts. And to the extent that Republicans tend to use partisan gerrymandering more than Democrats do, then that suggests a problem for progressive policymaking. But I do want to point out that Republicans aren't the only ones that use gerrymandering, and probably no state is as proficient in gerrymandering as Maryland is, but maybe North Carolina. But North Carolina keeps getting the trouble with the courts on it, on the kind of gerrymandering they've been doing, which has largely had racial impacts, which is not true in Maryland. It's complete partisan gerrymandering in Maryland. I think that in some ways, like, gerrymandering is a problem, but I think we overstate it sometimes as to what kind of impact it actually is going to have on the representation that we do have at the federal level. I think we have a much bigger problem as far as political power, the distribution of political power goes, by having the Senate composed the way it is, and having it have as much power as it actually has.
So would you be supportive of expanding the number of senators and having it tied to population in states?
Yeah, that would require a constitutional amendment. But I mean, if we're going to talk about solutions, I would rather see the Senate be an entirely advisory body for the most part, and expand the House of Representatives and make it more of a parliamentary system with formal roles for political parties and incorporating political, like a party list voting along with constituency voting, as you see in some European democracies. It's not the way they do it in England, but they do it that way in Scotland. I'm just thinking that there was a recent election there, so I'm good familiar with that.
Interesting, yeah. And ending the filibuster is something that you might also support if you're kind of putting the spotlight on the Senate as a source of some of the gridlock we have in Washington?
Yeah, I think we need a whole other show to talk about the filibuster and its history and what it represents. But let's just say that I've held for a long time, and I may be wrong about this, but I think I'm right, that the filibuster is unconstitutional. The Constitution requires that the Senate and the House pass laws, except in specific circumstances, by a majority vote. The reason that they get away with the filibuster right now is because the Senate can at any time, with a majority, get rid of the filibuster. Right. So that's what we've been talking about now anyways. It's like the filibuster is what? It's 60 votes, right? But you don't need 60 votes to get rid of the filibuster. If that was the case, it would unquestionably be unconstitutional.
Yeah. Okay. So these are exactly the types of ideas that I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about. Rob, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us on Trickle Down Socialism.
My pleasure. I love the show, Pat. This was fun.
Thanks for listening to Trickle Down Socialism. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd love to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, ideas for future topics that we should cover, please give us a call at 781-343-1813 and leave us a message at 781-343-1813. And remember to subscribe so you know exactly when our next episode drops. See you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.